My name is John Hamry. I'm the president at CSIS, and I'm a firm believer that when people come on time, you have to reward them by starting on time. And so I want to say thank you to all of you for coming. We've got really a great day in front of us, and I'm very grateful for this impressive group of speakers who are willing to share their insights on the upcoming G20 summit. Let me just first say sincere thanks to the International Chamber of Commerce and to the U.S. Council for International Business for being our partners. We're very grateful to have them for this. Most Americans hear about the G20 and they don't really have a clue what it's about. You know, it's just an outcome that shows up in the news, and they really don't understand the dynamic that underlies it. And of course, this is a relatively new phenomena in kind of international governance, and born out of necessity. How are we going to deal with all of these sovereign states that are wrestling with transcending problems? I mean, when you think about it, the problems in the world are now horizontal and the governments are vertical. And how do we bring this together, and how do we work through these very, very taxing problems? Well, you know, the way that started, I guess, with the G7, but widely felt that the G7 was an inadequate combination because it didn't reflect the full span and diversity and depth of the changing, evolving international system. So the G20 emerged, and that's, of course, what we're going to explore today. We have the benefit of people who know something about this, who are going to share their insights with us. And I must say, I'm very much looking forward to that. Ambassador Surikhan is on the way. He had a last-minute hang-up, and then there's a little bit of a traffic issue. But he will be here shortly, and so we did want to begin. And, of course, I do want to say a sincere thanks to Terry McGraw, who's our co-host today, and we will get into this program. But let me now turn, if I may, to Matt Goodman. Matt is the Scholl Chair here at CSIS, has been doing a fabulous job. He was, what do you call a Sue Sherpa? Is that what, I don't know what the term is, you know, or the, you know, not quite Sherpa, you know, near Sherpa, something like that. And Matt was a Sue Sherpa on a couple of occasions. We're going to have Mike Froman, who was a Primo Sherpa, or again, I don't know what these terms here, but I'm going to learn, and I'm going to get off of the stage and make sure that we can get real expertise going. So Matt, why don't you come up and let's get this started for real.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Hamry. Yes, that G20 terminology is very complicated. A Sue Sherpa is actually the State Department senior official or the Treasury Department senior official who works with the Sherpa. I was actually, as Mike's deputy, I was actually called the Yak, which is a proud term for those of us who have served in that role. And in fact, my predecessor had the Yak written on his business card. I couldn't quite go that far, but anyway, good morning. Welcome to CSIS. Let me join Dr. Hamry in welcoming such a big and enthusiastic group to this event. We're thrilled to have you. And I want to also join Dr. Hamry in thanking our co-hosts, the International Chamber of Commerce and the U.S. Council for International Business. And we're going to be hearing more from them shortly. I want to also give a shout out to Jeff Hardy, who's been my partner in organizing this. Jeff is the coordinator for the G20 advisory group of the ICC, and he's been a great partner in planning this event. When we started planning it about 2 months ago, it seemed that the global economy was, and the global environment was relatively benign, even headed in the right direction. Europeans seem to have found a way of muddling through their sovereign debt and banking problems. Growth and job creation seem to be picking up fairly steadily here in the U.S. China was slowing, but again, apparently in a sort of benign way. And even Japan had a pretty good first quarter. So the smart money was on brighter days ahead. And we thought that the conversation here was going to be about whether the G20 remains relevant because there isn't this sense of crisis and impending doom. Well, 2 months is a lifetime in global economics, and things have changed. It is now clear that with the bad economics economic numbers pretty much everywhere in the world. It's really hard to find a bright spot on the horizon. And financial strains rising again, it certainly feels like there's a sense of crisis reemerging, the kind of feeling that was emerging in late 2008 when the G20 was elevated to a leaders' level forum. So we now, I think, have to ask this question again: is the G20 relevant again because of this impending crisis? And we will know in 2 weeks. At least we'll have a partial answer, because with brilliant foresight, the Mexican government set June 18th and 19th, 2 weeks from this week, in Los Cabos as the date for the G20 summit, 5 months earlier than the normal November timing. And clearly, that was fortuitous, because there's going to be a lot for leaders to talk about. So today we will get a preview of what to expect at Los Cabos from a first-rate group of speakers and panelists. To kick things off, we have, and I'll just quickly run through the program so you know what to expect for the morning. First of all, we're going to have Terry McGraw, who, among many other things, is vice chairman of the ICC and a leader of the business community's engagement with the G20. I'll introduce Terry more fully in a moment. Following Terry, we're fortunate to have with us today Mexican Ambassador to the United States, Arturo Sarocan, to lay out Mexico's plans and objectives for the Los Cabos summit. And again, I'll introduce Ambassador Sarocan in a moment. We then have two first-rate panels to delve into the substantive agenda at Los Cabos. The first will cover the core macroeconomic and financial agenda. The second will look at other key items on the expanded G20 agenda that are of particular interest to business and other stakeholders, including trade, energy, and green growth, and other subjects. Let me say as an aside that the role of non-governmental stakeholders, including business, in the G20's deliberation was relatively late to develop. Frankly, this is because, unlike other forums like APEC, which I've also worked on, in which stakeholder engagement is hardwired and was hardwired from the beginning in the conversation, the G20 was, again, born in crisis and was really a vehicle for governments to address an immediate problem or set of problems. And consultation with business and other stakeholders came a bit later. But it is now a very important part of the conversation and the policy development framework, and we thought it was important to highlight this today because I think not many people in Washington are aware of those connections. So we'll wrap things up after the two panels at lunch with Terry back on stage to join me for a conversation with Deputy National Security Advisor Mike Froman and G20 Sherpa, just Sherpa. So we've got a rich and full agenda today, and let's get started. I'm delighted to now properly introduce Terry McGraw, Chairman, President, and Chief Executive Officer of the McGraw-Hill Companies, a leading global financial information and education company. Terry joined the McGraw-Hill Companies in 1980 and has held a number of positions with increasing responsibility in the firm, rising to the level of CEO in 1998 and Chairman in 1999. He is actively involved in policy forums of a variety of across a wide variety of issues and regions of the world. He's chairman of the Emergency Committee for American Trade. He's chairman of the United States Council for International Business. He's the immediate past chairman of the U.S.-India Business Council, a former chairman of the Business Roundtable, and importantly for today's purposes, vice chairman of the International Chamber of Commerce. So with no further ado, let me introduce Terry.
Okay, thanks very much, and good morning, everybody, and thank you for taking the time to be here. We had a dinner last night, and we were kicking off some things, and one of the things that I think is most important is that we really say a huge thank you to everybody that wants to be a part of this and has a role to play or a part to play. In a couple weeks, we'll be in Los Cabos, we have a very terrific opportunity to be able to really get after some priorities and to make something happen. When we were at in Cannes, France, at the G20, it was essentially a very robust agenda, and it was taken over by a lot of the problems associated with Europe. A lot of the issues were focused on what they need to do and what their thoughts are. And since that time, one of the things that has come to pass is that those issues are now influencing significantly world growth. 40% of Europe's exports go to the United States. The United States was thinking that, for the most part, most consensus was that it was going to grow about 2.5%, maybe as much as 3% in 2012. Now I think the hope is that if we could get to 2%, that would be a great number. My guess is it's going to be lower than that. And so what is this contagion effect, that we're seeing coming out of Europe going to be on the United States, on Japan, on the Asian markets? We're already seeing the BRIC markets, starting to contract after years and years of hoping that Brazil would be in a position of showing great growth. We're starting to see some retraction there. We're seeing it in India, and, of course, we're seeing it in China as well. And the effect and the contagion effect of that, on some of the emerging markets is also going to be remarkable. Now, I don't want to get negative. This is a very opportunistic, this is a very important time to really set forward a really important agenda set with some very, very strong priorities as to what it is that we can do. And everybody here and those that are going to Los Cabos in a couple weeks' time, have a role to play in terms of helping to make, the case for why this agenda is so important. And the agenda cannot be this long. We've got to set clear priorities. Is food security, is green energy, is employment, is transparency, all of these issues, are these important? Yes. But I think there are some more that have got to take a higher order. If we're about, thinking about economic growth, if we're thinking about job creation, if we're thinking about higher levels of prosperity and better standards of living for more of the populations that are going to be involved here on that way, then we have to set some very clear priorities. And I've got some ideas that I hope, and we can talk about them through the agenda today, that we need to be focused on. But your help and your support and being here today is very important in terms of the voice of business and the role that business can. And I say this, with all sincerity. This problem in terms of economic growth and all of these things is not going to be answered by government response. Okay, it is going to be government and business together working on this issue. And we've got to get to a situation where business and government are finding their voice and finding their ability to do things together in all of this. And if we don't, this problem is only going to get exacerbated, and it's going to just have more ripple effects for more of the populations that we're trying to serve in all of that. So we've got to find that kind of role. And I'm so proud with Jean-Guy and ICC and the USCIB with Peter Robinson and all that we're all trying to do here with the Center for Strategy and International Studies to try and bring this business-government role together and to set some very clear priorities in terms of the B20. Alejandro Ramirez, who has been picked by President Calderon to lead the B20 effort, for Mexico, will be speaking later. And he has done such a terrific job in such a short period of time to bring this all together. And so, again, to all the people that have helped, it's not the principals, it's the people that have been behind that that have helped to create this environment and the excitement about what Los Cabos can mean in terms of this G20. Let me just highlight very quickly a couple ideas in terms of the agenda going forward. Now, of all the issues that we can be talking about, I think there are three that we have to focus on. And again, through our deliberations today and how we come out, we'll talk about what kind of recommendations the B20 can take to the G20 in Los Cabos in a couple of weeks. First and foremost, We have got to be about enhancing the capital markets. Now, you know, we can talk about the banking system. We can talk about all aspects of how you raise capital and the like. The bottom line is, through capital requirements and through other kinds of issues, banks are not going to be able to do the heavy lift in terms of the lending and the requirements for all the capital that's needed, especially for the infrastructure development. Now, you know, these are big numbers, and, you know, and a lot of study and a lot of thinking has gone into this. But, you know, the OECD came out with a number of that between now and 2030, not very long on that one, we need $70 trillion, okay, just for infrastructure financing in our world. $70 trillion. I don't even know what $70 trillion looks like. That. That's a huge number, okay? Standard & Poor's came out with a number in terms of financing of a little over $40 trillion by 2016, okay? And this is for non-financial corporations around the world. I think, where is that money coming from? It's not going to come from banks. In the United States, 80% of the funds raised, for the private sector and the like, you know, 80%, comes from the capital markets, 20% from banks. In Europe right now, it's the other way around. It's 80% from banks and 20% from the capital markets. And by the way, that number is only going to go up, over the next whatever years, who knows? But it'll be 40%, 50% thing. And one of the things that we're seeing around the world is the development of local bond markets all over. And why? Because they're taking the playbook from some of the developed countries in terms of the mechanisms on how you're going to raise capital. So one of the things that this has to be about, okay, if we're talking about economic growth and job creation and prosperity and all those things, right, is where's that capital coming from on that one? And to enhance the capital markets and to improve, the functioning of those capital markets has to be number one priority if it's about economic growth. The second one, I think we've got to really focus on the trade agenda. Protectionism is rampant. Everybody wants to go it alone. You can't do that. There was a time when the United States was 45% of world GDP. Fine. If you're 45% of world GDP, I guess you can do just about anything you want. Over the next 3 years, the United States will be 15%, 1-5, of world GDP. What does that say? That says that you better get along with others, and you better find ways to develop partnerships. You better find ways to have these kind of relationships. And we need to do things in a cooperative way, better together in all that. And one of the ways of doing that is the whole trade agenda. And so we have to be able to push more aggressively on how do we open markets, how do we liberalize markets, and we can talk about Trans-Pacific partnerships, we can talk about neutrality, we can talk about free trade agreements, we can talk about model bilateral investment treaties, we can talk about all of that and whatever. But if we don't have a more robust trade agenda and a more cooperative approach to what trade means to us, then, again, I come back. Economic growth is going to be what suffers on that part. And, again, if nobody is going to be so singularly, polar, then we have to find more ways to cooperate and do things together. The third one I think that we have to put on our agenda is a whole notion of intellectual property rights. In the manufactured world, right, if I steal your tractor, we know that's not good. There's penalties for that, and you're going to pay a price on that one. But when it comes to content, when it comes to services on this one, it's rampant. People hack, people take. I don't have to pay for that. And if the services industry, which is coming on so strong in terms of a percentage of our overall economy, is vital to our economic growth, then we have to have a sense of responsibility about what intellectual property right and protections mean. On that one, and we have to be able to do those things. But the bottom line is that business and government have to work together, and we have this opportunity, once again, in Los Cabos, to cut together with the G20 and to have the B20, the voice of business, working with the G20 to say, we can do this. If it's about economic growth, if it's about job creation, prosperity, all of those kind of things, whatever, there's things that we can do. And I think the first three, that I brought up, enhancing the capital markets, trade and investment, and protection of intellectual property, are three things that we got to have something positive to come out of this session with. So we got one more time, one more opportunity. We'll get another one in Russia, and we'll get another one somewhere else. Okay, but this is our time right now. And business and government have a role to play in terms of making this all happen. So anyway, thanks for being here. Thanks for coming. We'll see so many of you in Los Cabos. Find your voice. Make sure that people are hearing your intensity and your urgency for business and government to work together. And let's have a great conference and all of that, and I hope the ambassador is here. he is. Good. Matt, back to you.
Okay. Thank you, Terry. Well, you've laid some good, important issues on the table, and I think we'll have a chance to talk about them at a couple of other points in the conference. So thank you for that introduction. Now let me introduce our keynote speaker this morning, Ambassador Arturo Sarukhan. We're delighted to have Ambassador Sarukhan here. He is the ambassador of Mexico to the United States. He has been in that role since early 2007. Ambassador Sarukhan is a career diplomat. He served in many important positions in Mexico City and around the world, and as I said, has been in the United States since 2007, but had served here on a couple of occasions before that. He also, the most interesting thing, I think, on his resume is that he went to the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University, which is also my alma mater, and that means he must be all right. So that's terrific. But actually, seriously, much more interesting on his bio, I'd suggest you go to his Wikipedia site, because his family history is really quite extraordinary. It's like a Tolstoy novel with some Hemingway mixed in, how his family got to Mexico from originally Armenia and Spain via Venice and a French concentration camp, and it's really a fascinating story and a real example of, if we can call it, the North American dream come true. So we're delighted to have Ambassador Sarukhan with us, and look forward to his presentation of Mexico's plans for the Los Cabos summit and your objectives for the G20. Thanks so much, Ambassador Sarukhan.
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you to all at CSIS for convening what I think is a very timely forum as we hit the last milestone on the road to Cabo San Lucas, or Cabos. Good news is our convention center is ready. That's what I read or heard, so I think we're ready to receive all of you in style in Cabo. But I think obviously that this discussion this morning will be very relevant. I know Mike Froman, who's been a fantastic colleague as the U.S. Sherpa, working with Mexico to ensure that we can get a successful outcome with concrete deliverables, or as concrete as possible, in Cabo San Lucas. Obviously, also, I have to tread carefully, because this is the finance ministry baby, and obviously the foreign ministry plays a role, but I don't want to get either ahead of where the finance ministry is moving a lot of these issues, or B, project issues that I think are important for the G20 per se, but which may not necessarily be on the agenda this time around. But I obviously have to start by stating, and this is it's not rocket science, but I think there's a very important thing to be said about Mexico, the second emerging economy and the first country in Latin America to be hosting the G20. In many ways, it is about leadership, presidential leadership, but it's also about a world vision of where Mexico needs to be standing in the construction of a of a new architecture, which will have to deal with not only the emergence of a truly multipolar world, but of the atomization and diffusion of power, whether it's economic or military, measured in other ways, soft power, for example. And I would obviously like to stress that I think that what Mexico brings to the table is a unique pivoting position between developing economies and emerging economies. It's not the first time that we have played and sought to play this role. I think for those of you who sort of straddle the economic and development worlds, if you followed COP16 in Cancun closely 2 years ago, in many ways, even though we're talking, these are two very different sandlots, I think that the experiences that Mexico brought to bear in COP16 in Cancun have also played a very significant role in this, on the road to the G20, on a number of fronts. Number one, how we see Mexico's ability to engage and to bring in different perspectives. We do believe that we have a new diplomatic toolbox for providing global solutions to global challenges. We do believe that traditional multilateral institutions may have become a bit too unwieldy to take on some of the new challenges that we're facing. But more importantly, I think that for a country like mine, that doesn't have the ability of this country to project power, there are two ways to go around the world. You sit at the table, or you're on the menu. And the best way to sit at the table is to participate in the development and building of a post-Westphalian, rules-based international system. And I do think that what makes Mexico slightly different from other emerging economies is that we do believe in a rules-based international system. Look at what we've done on IPR. We and South Korea are the only two emerging economies that signed, that negotiated and signed ACTA. And you were talking about the importance of IPR, and IPR is a motor of growth and trade in the world economy. But the fact that Mexico, along with other partners, the U.S., Canada, the European Union, Australia, New Zealand, South Korea, and I think I'm slighting Morocco, because I think Morocco was another one of the emerging, I'm looking for my economic team, Morocco was on the ACTA, right? Yeah. So it's actually South Korea, Mexico, and Morocco that negotiated ACTA. But I think this is a very compelling and telling example of how Mexico is trying to build a new rules-based international global system. We do believe in free trade. Mexico, along with Chile, has probably the most ambitious and largest free trade agreement on free trade agreement network on the face of the earth. And this is one of the challenges that we also face as we head into Cabo San Lucas, which is how do we regain and rebuild the credibility that G20 has to have? And I say this quite bluntly. Look at past G20 summits. Everyone leaves the summit promising to not create artificial barriers to trade. 5 seconds after everyone's left the G20 summit, half of the countries in the G20 is erecting trade barriers. And so how do you take on protectionism? How do you provide the G20 with the ability to preach what it is? It's sort of walking the walk besides talking the talk. These are some of the structural challenges that I think Mexico has tried to take on. But also, how do we straddle two sometimes very different perspectives about development, growth? We saw it again at COP16, where I think Mexico, being an emerging economy, said, hold on a minute, yes, the industrialized world does have a historic responsibility for carbon mitigation, simply because of the historical footprint of the Western industrialized economies. But not because we are a growing economy do we have lesser responsibility in mitigating carbon emissions. And we do have a responsibility, regardless of the size of our economy, in bringing down those carbon emissions. That same approach to finding ways in which we can bridge emerging economies and the industrialized world, I think, has played a very important role on the road to Cabo San Lucas. It is clear that we will have some very important background noise on the road to Cabo San Lucas, and maybe even during the summit itself. And it's a global economy which is held by pins. The evolving crises in Europe, I hope I'm wrong, but I think will intrude into the best laid plans of the issues that we've sought to put on the table for discussion of the leaders once we reach the summit. So we have to be aware that this may be playing out as we deal with some of the issues that I will address in a few moments. But this will be a critical juncture. And yes, we will have more G20 summits down the road. But I think, and I agree, that there is a very particular and prescient nature to this summit because of what is happening in the larger global economy as we head to Cabo San Lucas. I think that as you look at the road that Mexico has taken to reach Cabo, you will find two things that I think make Mexico's presidency or chair of the G20 summit slightly different from what we've seen in the past: inclusiveness and co-stakeholdership. I think that there has been a tremendous effort made by the Mexican government to use the same template, different mold, but same template that we used in COP16. That is, promote active and engaged participation of non-G20 members, countries that are not formal part of the G20 but have something to say, either because of what is happening in the global economy or because they have a relevant role in terms of chairing global and chairing regional groups around the world. So we've brought in non-members. We've had a very active engagement with NGOs, with think tanks, with civil society and the private sector. I think it is an encompassing, open, and transparent dialogue. And I think, hopefully, this will change some of the dynamics that we've seen, because I don't think that in this day and age you can continue to have summits which are not engaging with public opinion and civil society. We can't go to these summits anymore and hammer out deals in the dark that later have absolutely no grounding with civil society, that have no buy-in by the private sector, by NGOs, and then expect people to simply gobble these things up. There has to be a conveyor belt between civil society, NGOs, the private sector, and others, so that whatever comes out of Cabo San Lucas has a fair chance of moving forward, gaining traction, and succeeding. Therefore, if you look at some of the fora that Mexico has organized, and Alejandro has played a key role in the B20 component, and I want to thank him for coming up here in the midst of what must be a very, very busy next couple of weeks as we approach Cabo San Lucas. But for example, Think 20, which took place in Mexico in February, which was to examine the Mexican priorities of the G20, to create a debate over whether these priorities were right, whether we should refocus, re-engage, fine-tune, I think was a very, very productive example. And ways to increase the effectiveness of the Leader Summit per se and the mechanics of the Leader Summit. Another example, Y20 young people. The final recommendations, the Y20 Puebla agreement, was delivered to President Felipe Calderón, again with the idea of being able to create a sense of co-stakeholdership and buy-in from different social groups. The constant engagement that we've had now 3 meetings of Sherpas, 1 of foreign ministers, and if I miss one or I'm, just let me know, Alejandro. 3 meetings of Sherpas, 1 of foreign ministers, 2 of finance ministers, 1 of trade ministers, 1 of labor ministers, 1 of tourism ministers, because of the very important role that tourism plays in the economies of countries like my own and of this country. I don't have to remind this group that President Obama, several months back, made a call for the United States to re-engage and to take advantage of its ability to create tourism and the importance that tourism plays in the economy of the United States. We've had 3 meetings of deputy finance ministers and 2 meetings of deputy agricultural ministers, with a myriad of several other working group meetings. The next steps on the road to Cabo, sort of the non-official informal activities, there will be a very important seminar, Innovative Thinking for Global Challenges, Constructing the G20 Agenda for the Future, that will take place June 16 in Los Cabos. We've designed this as a mix of heads of state, private sector, academia, civil society to foster outside-the-box thinking for future G20 meetings and for the agenda. What does the G20 agenda need to look like as we go down the road? And I agree absolutely with you that, there's a natural tension between trying to focus on two or three key drivers of global economic growth, but at the same time, we can't be blind to other ancillary issues that are out there and that are impinging upon our ability to grow. So how do you deal with the need to be able to, yes, focus on the core issues to create global economic growth and to mitigate global financial crises, but at the same time, so many of the other issues that are out there, some of them that you mentioned that we have injected into the G20 summit, which do have an impact. And one of them, which is, none of you will be surprised to hear me say this, it has no role in the G20 today. There was a discussion precisely in the Think 20 forum as to whether something like this should be inserted into the discussions. But for a country like mine and for this hemisphere, how do you take on the challenge of transnational organized crime and illicit monies making their way to the global economy is a clear issue that somehow, I don't know if it needs to be front and center, a issue of the leader summit per se, but in future G20s, there will have to be at some point, whether it's through one of these innovative mechanisms that we've developed, there has to be some out-of-the-box thinking of other ancillary issues that are impacting the ability of the world economy to grow. But I think that this seminar will provide us with a unique opportunity right before the leader summit per se kicks off to be able to have sort of an out-of-the-box blue skies discussion as to how do we move this agenda forward in the next years. Then we'll have the B20 per se, which Alejandro has been so skillfully marshaling, June 17 and 18 in Los Cabos, to try and find ways in which we can create this greater bond and this greater sense of co-stakeholdership between the private sector and the public sector in developing sustainable growth at the global level. And then, obviously, in the G20 per se, with the leaders, how do we focus on specific measures, concrete agreements, and commitments to overcome current international challenges, the lack of economic growth, and the need for policy coordination? In this regard, I think that Mexico's, what has led to what Mexico's agenda looks like for the G20 per se. A commitment to follow up on previous G20 priorities so that we don't, you know, throw everything out and start afresh in Cabo. We're picking up where issues have been left behind in previous G20 summits. But issues that highlight the importance of G20 development agenda for emerging markets and developing nations alike. The five structural components of the Mexican agenda for G20 are, one, economic stabilization and structural reforms as foundations for growth and employment. Two, the strengthening of financial system, the strengthening of the international financial system and fostering financial inclusion to promote economic growth. Three, improving the international financial architecture in an interconnected world. And two additional issues, which are particularly Mexican, but which my president, my government believes have a very profound impact on these first three drivers. Four, enhancing food security and addressing commodity price volatility, simply because of the impact this is having on social and economic well-being of a series of countries around the world. And five, promoting sustainable development, green growth, and the fight against climate change. I think there are two components here that the Mexican presidency will be seeking to address in particular. One is sustainable development through green growth, which is a cross-cutting issue. I do believe that you can chew gum and whistle at the same time. I think it is possible and economically sound. You can have growth, but at the same time look at issues that are profoundly important for sustainable economic development. Obviously, you need proper incentives, regulations, and financing necessary for achieving this growth. They're still not there. They're still not part of the mix. But I think one of the things that we hope to see, especially in the seminar the day before, is how can we start thinking much more creatively about the nexus between economic growth and sustainability. And then some of the new toys and mechanisms that are out there that have been discussed, which we need to bring down to earth a bit and try and find ways in which we can get them up and running. For example, one of Mexico's keystone proposals, which is the Green Climate Fund, and how do you provide RED and other mechanisms with a bit more traction than what we've seen as of Cancun and certainly as of Durban last year in COP17. I think there have been several achievements so far on the road toward the G20 Leaders Summit worth highlighting. I know that a lot of people out there, and especially public opinion, sort of say, look at this summit tree and say there are so many summits that it's starting to look like a mountain range. And then there's the issue of how do you provide a sense that this summit tree is delivering the goods. And I think there's an understandable skepticism towards how effective some of these mechanisms can be. But I think there are important achievements. The first meeting of financial ministers on the road to Cabo San Lucas committed to an increase in resources to the IMF for loans of over $430 billion, $180 billion more than what was agreed to in 2009, and an agreement to review current structure of quotas and IMF governance. The Deputy Ministers of Agriculture meeting agreed to implement the G20 Action Plan on Volatility of Agricultural Prices and to support food security, taking advantage of genetic resources, better manage water resources, and promote sustainable agriculture. The Tourism Ministers meeting, how to harness tourism industry as an alternative for job creation. And again, this is an area where I think Mexico and the United States have been working closely hand in hand. And then finally, working group on development, best practices in massive public transport system in urban areas, and inclusive and guidance on inclusive green growth policies. As you can tell, I think that Mexico has really tried to look at this template with a different prism and to create a sense of a traction, but also be able to leave to trigger a discussion which will allow the next G20 countries to move the agenda forward. I think that while urgent matters will be addressed at G20, Mexico is pushing for a holistic agenda that addresses the short terms without giving short thrift to the long-term vision and how we need to create a much more inclusive but much more effective G20 mechanism. And I do hope that regardless of the specific issues that we will seek to deliver on these five drivers that I have shared with you, that one of Mexico's legacies will be to leave a much more stronger foundational architecture for G20 in the coming years. Thank you very much.
So the ambassador is willing to take a couple of questions. We have a few minutes, so if anyone has a question, please raise your hand, and there's a microphone which will come forward right here. David, there's a gentleman in the second row. And please identify yourself and ask a question. Thank you.
Hi, thanks so much, Ambassador. My name is Jamie Strawbridge. I cover the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations for Inside U.S. Trade. This upcoming G20 summit seems like as good a chance as any for the U.S. and Mexico to make some sort of announcement about Mexico joining the TPP negotiations. Are you expecting anything to come out concrete on this topic? And is Mexico doing anything in advance to try to get as much as it can on TPP? Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Look, I am, and the Mexican government is absolutely convinced that the most important geostrategic vision thing out there today for the Americas and for the United States and Mexico is the TPP, for a number of reasons. It's about job creation and economic competitiveness. It's about how do we enhance the North American share of global trade through Asia Pacific, especially when we have finally, friends on Capitol Hill have started to understand, and in the media too, have started to understand the incredible relevance of these supply and production chains that we've developed in North America as a result of NAFTA, and how this has allowed North America, despite the profound economic crises that we saw in 2009, you know, to more or less walk through this unscathed. President Obama was rightly proud in his State of the Union at the beginning of the year to trumpet the comeback of Detroit and the car industry in the United States. What he did not say, it's not his role to say, but I, as the Mex ambassador, will crow about this, is that one of the reasons why Detroit was able to make a comeback was because of these integrated supply and production chains that we've developed in North America through small and medium entrepreneurs and companies that were able to reduce costs, enhance delivery capability of products, and allow Detroit to, with the stimuli that were put on the table, to come back from the brink relatively quickly. So, I think it's a no-brainer in terms of job creation and the competitiveness of North America, especially vis-a-vis some of the new global economic players. Two, in many ways, it's the upgrading of NAFTA through the back door. NAFTA was a 1.0 free trade agreement. TPP is a 2.0 free trade agreement, especially if you look at issues like IPR, data protection, environment standards. And so in many ways, this would allow us to upgrade NAFTA without having to go into the delicate and dicey process of renegotiating NAFTA to upgrade it as an agreement, which I think all of you in this room, or most of you in this room, I assume would agree, is like throwing a wrench into the works. I think it would be like opening Pandora's box if we were to go down that route. So, two, I think it upgrades our free trade agreement in North America. But finally, it's also about my tongue-in-cheek coalition of the willing. It binds like-minded countries in the Americas that have free trade agreements amongst ourselves, that lie on the Pacific coast of the Americas, that some of us are APEC members, and it provides a very interesting new inter-American interconnection of countries that are working together not only through free trade agreements in the Americas, but also across the Pacific in engaging our Pacific partners. So this is sort of a very long prologue to your question, which is this is absolutely relevant for Mexican foreign policy. I think it is a no-brainer for North American competitiveness. I think that we were very clear in underscoring when we announced our decision to seek adherence to TPP in Hawaii in the last APEC summit that Mexico was ready to start negotiating with the other TPP partners. And so we do hope that we can reach a point by Cabo where we can move this ball forward. I certainly think I would not put this as sort of the – this is not the Rubicon. If we're not ready for Cabo, we may not be ready for Cabo, but I certainly think that the Mexican government is looking to ensure that by the end of this year, by the time this Mexican administration hands in power on December the 1st, we have moved this ball far enough forward so that there are no U-turns on what is, I think, a seminal decision for North American competitiveness. So what we have asked of our friends on Capitol Hill, and we have had, I think, a very important support from a very large bipartisan group of members on the Hill, is that we be able to address the issues. I think Mexico is ready to address some of the outstanding IPR issues which are germane to TPP. We have been quite clear in saying also we don't think that bilateral issues which are not directly linked to TPP should be linked to TPP negotiations. Yes, we have issues on potatoes and beef, but I don't think these should be linked directly to the negotiations for the accession of TPP.
We have maybe one more question way back there.
Thank you very much. My name is Junwei. I'm with the U.S.-China Foundation for Education and Economic Development. I have a question. What's your expectations to China's constructive roles in the summit? Thank you very much.
There's a saying in Mexico in Spanish that says zapatero a tus zapatos, which translated into English means basically if you're a cobbler, stick to your shoes, which basically is a nice way of saying I have no idea. I'm not responsible for the relationship with China. I know that our B20, our Sherpa, and our finance ministry team have been engaging constructively and intensely with the Chinese government. I think there is a sound, solid partnership with China. Mexico has a sort of a different template of trade relations with China, especially if you compare it to the rest of Latin America, where you see a lot of commodity-driven trade between China, South America. The trade template between China and Mexico is very different. You don't see commodities as a driver of that relationship or that trade relationship. But I think I can speak for my colleagues who are dealing with the Chinese either in the bilateral relationship or through the Sherpa and the B20 process, that I think that there's been a healthy engagement with the Chinese government. I think we're looking to find constructive and imaginative ways of dealing with those issues in which we don't see eye to eye, as we did, I think, in Cancun, in COP16, on issues like carbon sequestration and carbon emissions, where China and Mexico did have two different perspectives on the issue.
One more burning question I saw back there, and then we'll, if that's all right, and then we'll stop. We have 30 seconds. The gentleman there with his hand up.
Thank you. I'm Greg Rushford. I published the Rushford Report on trade politics. If it's important to upgrade NAFTA and the TPP, should Canada be part of this process in the TPP also?
I can't speak for the Canadian government, but if you're looking at how this will impact North American competitiveness, there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that two key countries in providing for this architecture, Canada and Mexico, and that the effectiveness of North American trade will be positively impacted by both Canada and Mexico joining the TPP. What we have said, which may be what is lying behind your question and which you politely did not ask, was what we don't want to see happen is that the three of us have to wait for the three of us to be ready to sit down and negotiate. What we've said is allow us alternative multiple speeds of negotiation and of accession to TPP, because if one country like Mexico is ready to sit down and negotiate today, and there's still a debate in Japan and Canada may or may not be ready to sit down today and negotiate, what we don't want to see is Mexico being hindered by a lack of progress with the other two countries that announced their intention to join TPP. So, A, we would want to see multiple speeds of entry. If the other two countries are not ready to sit down today, which Mexico is ready to do, but B, in terms of the architecture that we need to build in North America, Canada is a critically important component of this. Canada, Mexico's point of view would be that Canada needs to be in TPP.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador. Really appreciate those very thoughtful comments and also responses. And let me say that in my experience as a YAC, Mexico, to the point that the ambassador said at the beginning about Mexico being determined to contribute to the building of the global architecture and be a champion of the rules-based system, that was very much my experience. I think, frankly, the group of countries in the G20 are not all quite so committed to those objectives, but Mexico clearly stood out as one of those that was really quite constructive and a real leader in the forum. So I have every expectation that the summit is going to be a very well-managed event and produce really good outcomes under Mexican leadership. So let's please thank the ambassador for his time.